Accession number 20094, Reel 9.
George Lester, Reel 9.
Yes, well, Stonecutters Wireless Station was just equipped with the shore station transmitters only. These transmitters were remote controlled via landlines from Hong Kong Island, by landlines which went across to Kowloon and from Kowloon to Stonecutters Island. The landlines were owned by the Army. The receivers and all the receiving was done at the headquarters in Hong Kong Island, which is known as CSHQ. That was the Combined Services Headquarters. At Stonecutters Island, obviously, in 1946, was not all that long after the station had been got back on the air again fully. Some of the equipment was mobile Marconi transmitters called SWB-8s, run from diesel engines. And these were in a compound, all attached to the aerials. And there was an installation party on the station which were connecting up and putting in, installing new transmitters, Marconi SWB-8s, SWB-8s, and SWB-11s. There were four American transmitters, TE-435As, which were connected up to aerials, which operated on 4, 8, 12, and 15 megacycle bands for the area broadcast for the British Pacific Fleet. These, again, were controlled from CSHQ in Hong Kong. Some of the, as the new transmitters over the years, I was there at least two years. Over the ensuing years, the transmitters, some of the older transmitters, were taken out of service, and the new installed transmitters were brought online. But we always had a problem with the landlines. As I say, these were owned and maintained by the Army. They were initially laid when Stonecutters Island was a fortress, virtually, with gun emplacements for the protection of the entrance, the southern entrance to the Hong Kong and Kowloon Gap. The aerials that were mounted on three very large masts, looked like the Eiffel Tower type masts in that shape. They were 375 foot high. And they were such that we had two lots of stays between between these masts, which had various types of aerials. To be technical, we had collinear arrays on cut to certain frequencies. We had dipoles and ordinary VFTDs, vertically folded terminated dipoles, all different kinds of aerials to maintain the service. Because as well as the area broadcast, we operated the what we call the 5-ton, 500 kcs, for the Merchant Navy broadcasts. We operated a transmitter for the port waves, and we operated what we call the fixed services. A fixed service to Admiralty, to London, a fixed service to Singapore, a fixed service to Colombo, and a fixed service to Australia. Australian one was closed down, service was closed down shortly after I left the station, shortly after I joined the station. These six services, obviously, depending upon the time of the day, had to have their frequencies changed. Whereby you, during the daytime, the heaviside layer would be quite high. At night time, it's the heaviside layer, which the high frequency waves bounce off from, would become lower. So you had to go to different frequencies. And that was our main job all the time, was maintaining the fixed services to London, Singapore, and Colombo, changing the frequencies all the time. Port wave, as its name infers, was a local wave that didn't change frequency. And the reason why you had four frequencies on the area broadcast was so that no matter where a ship was, any time of the day or night, it could tune in to the strongest signal, strongest frequency to receive the signals on the area broadcast. My time at Stonecutters was spent mainly as the, even though I was a lead and tell stroke lead and radio electrician, because as I mentioned earlier, I'd applied to change branches, but I was still being treated as a leading telegraphist, and as such, when we were on watch, I was called the petty officer of the watch. I was acting as petty officer of the watch. On the watch bill, running the station and changing the frequencies and going around checking to make certain everything was okay, was the petty officer of the watch and a radio mechanic. But as well as just changing the frequencies, you had to go around and keep check on the transmitters. Occasionally you get a telephone call saying that transmitter didn't sound right or something or other. Or you might have to find that you have to change over the keying lines on the keying line switchboard to enable the service to keep going. In saying that, one night all the keying lines went down and we had to turn out all the station staff, all the lead and tells, going around to all the transmitters and typing on the local Morse key on the transmitters that the server was temporarily suspended and given the call sign. We did this for a matter of about 5 or 6 hours, running around in little circles. The problem was that during the day, some coolies outside the station were digging a trench and they put the pickaxe through the lines. Now, it didn't short the lines out then, but during the night we had quite a heavy rainfall and the cable insulated cable, the pickaxe had gone through the outer casing, and inside the pairs of lines were only wax paper wrapped, and as the water got through into them, it shorted all the lines out, and so we were dead. We managed to get the army out because of their lines, we weren't able to touch them at first. Then in the end, we cut the lines. We actually cut the cable, and by putting temporary repairs across on the lines and heavily covering it with Vaseline and all the rest of it, we managed to get the station back on the air until the army came and fixed them properly. I spent some time, other than watchkeeping, on the actual aerial party itself, which meant going up the mast. Well, I like going up masts, always have done. Ever since I did my boy stint on the TS Exmouth and before the war, when we went, you used to have to go up the mast there. So I quite enjoy the aerial party. these three 75-foot masts, they had a staircase up the first 300 feet with little landings on as you went up. But the last 75 feet was a vertical ladder, which at the top was a platform with guardrails around it. The platform is about 9 foot by 9 foot, roughly 9 foot by 9 foot, with gratings, grating on the grating floor, metal grating floor. And I've often gone up there on Sundays. I'd say often, one or two occasions. But it was from there, and we, as well as the station crew, we did have some Chinese Navy personnel who are riggers, and they assisted on the aerial party. One of the things that I enjoyed doing was actually cutting and splicing the main wires, for the main aerial wire, for the when you actually the actual radiating parts of the aerial, your dipoles and things like that. These were many stranded copper wire formed up into like cables about 3 inches diameter copper. And what you had was giant, well, they looked like, if you imagine a rugby ball, but about nearly twice as big, and with holes going through it, not opposite each other. And what you did, you put the wire through there, and you spliced that, what we call them coconuts, you splice that onto there. And the other part of the aerial would be the other part of the coconut would be could be the main tritic stay part, separating it from the next aerial and things like that. Then we used to have from the centre of the aerial, you'd have one coconut in the middle of the dipole aerial. You'd have two feeder lines coming down, spaced 10 inches apart. And these were held off by ceramic 12-inch spacers, but with the holes in an inch from the end, which allowed you to put it over the wires, the connecting wires to the aerial, and get them 10 inches apart, and they should be fed back to the transmitting rooms and all the transmitters that they were serving. We built up a new aerial system called a rhombic, which is a diamond shape four wooden masts. They're about 80 to 100 foot tall. A diamond shape, and the axis of the last part of the diamond will be pointing towards London, either the short route or the long route, round pointing towards the UK. In other words, it was a beaming system. And you, depending on which end you fed the aerial, depended you went on the long route or the short route. This was called a four-wire rhombic. In other words, there were four element wires, which at the midpoint mass would be the four wires would be spaced about 6 foot over a distance of 6 foot down to virtually zero at the ends where they're being fed by the transmission lines. Sometimes you had to go and change, sometimes during the middle of the night, you had to go and change the route of the rhombic, which meant going down, disconnecting one lot of feeder lines and connect it to another lot of feeder lines to go on the other route. when we got to there were all together, when I first went to Stonecutters, we had two transmitting rooms in operation, TR1 and TR2, which were joined together. And as I say, we had a lot of transportable sets, swab eights and other things in wagons. Gradually, we got TR3 going, and TR4 and 5. These were the new transmitters were being installed, with new transmission line terminations connected into them. In TR5, they brought in a large, high-powered, very low-frequency set. His number was an R20A. This was a very, very powerful transmitter. To run this, to actually send, transmit on this, you needed quite a large low frequency aerial. So at the southern end of the station, there was a hill. This hill was on top of the armament depot, by the way, the Royal Naval Armament Depot, where all the armaments for the British Pacific Fleet were kept. And installed on there was where we put a 180-foot wooden mast. As it was already on the hill, that brought it up fairly near to the about three-quarters of the height of our main mast in the main compound. Main big masts. These big masts, by the way, were about 80 yards apart in a triangular formation. The big steel masts, and this one on top of the hill was about 200 yards away from that. I had the job of making the 400-foot low frequency aerial for this thing. There was four wires, four double of normal aerial wires, for four of those, but they were paired up, and so you really eight wires, but they're in pairs, four pairs, on a 30-foot spreader at either end. Now, obviously, if you don't cut them exact, you're going to get sagging and tilting and all the rest of it. Like, so we have to be very, very careful in cutting them. And luckily, by putting a little seizing every so often with a single strand of copper wire and soldering it, we managed to keep them so that they're... And actually, we managed to get them all four of these 400-long radiating elements to be exactly the same correct length.
400 what long?
400, the wires were 400 long, 400 feet long. And with two spreaders, one either end, so he had four lots of 400 wires, each wire being a double wire, the normal Admiralty aerial wire. Down at the... This was connected to a block at the station end onto a block on one of the legs of the 400-foot mast, the 375-foot mast, about 300 feet up. And with the block with the spreader coming away with their spreading shackles and all the rest of it to a central bull ring and then to a downhaul, onto a block. Underneath each of these masts, it's very simple to haul aerials up and down because we had a winch. Admittedly, it was a hand winch, but it was geared such that you could raise and lower the aerials quite easily. But the one on top of the hill was a wooden mast, and that had no winch. And so the way we had to do it, the road where they went past this there, we had to use the Jeep by connecting the block and tackles, connecting it to the bumper bar of the Jeep, and reversing the Jeep slowly down the hill, hauling up that way. So we managed to get the aerial up in position. And it was duly connected up to the TR-5. Now, without anybody knowing, the boys, the TR-5, they just carried on installing and running up this transmitter on dummy load and trying to get it to work properly. I was very friendly with the people in the Royal Naval Armament Depot. And one of them came up to me. By the way, my nickname on the station was Les, because there were three Georges on there. So they used the first syllable of my surname as my nickname. He came up and said, "Hey, Les," he said, "I can hear Morse inside the armament depot." I said, "Well, that's news to me." He said, "Come and have a listen." So I went into the armament depot. He took me in, and this was a labyrinth of tunnels underneath this hill, set into blocks where the armaments were kept, well, shells and cordite and things like that, with steel doors in front of them and what have you. So big roll of shutter doors they were. And when I got in there, I could hear it. I could hear the station call sign being transmitted. And it was the area broadcast call sign. G0043/86/123/1153. I thought, that's strange. And the notes sounded very much like a spark transmitter. And it was when we got under the tunnel to a disused part of there, which wasn't used, I discovered that there was a length of rail isolated from there to, next to some points, and there was a gap of about half an inch. Well, not quite half an inch. And that was the spark transmitter. Unbeknown to everybody else, the boys who were installing this thing in TR-5 had connected it up to the 400-foot aerial. This was in the radiated transmission was getting through the hill into the tunnel of the armament depot, causing a few little sparks. So I immediately come there and I was, Tom to switch off the aerial broadcast. Rung through. I said, "Why?" I said, if you don't, we might finish up in Hong Kong." So they switched off, and I phoned up the station commander, and I told him there. And so he switched off. Then he had the transmitters all transmitted on one at a time, and this it never came on again until one of the radio mechanics let on that they had the R20A in going. And they sort of suddenly realised that this very high-powered, low-frequency transmitter was putting radiation into there, causing that bit of line to spark. Whether it was anywhere else in the armour, I don't know, but anyway, that there was a danger. Because if the armament depot had gone up, well, I wouldn't be making this recording, and most of Hong Kong would have disappeared as well, along the jetty side anyway. So then we had the problem of digging up all the compounds in the area between the 375-foot steel mast, which was bonded to earth anyway, and the hill, digging trenches, not very deep trenches and squares, and putting in earthing plates. These were copper plates about a foot in diameter, a foot square, with wires, copper wire, rolled up, which you rolled out and laid in the trench. But you connected up, interconnected all the wires all over, so we laid a complete earth mat down underneath the surface of the station, and then covered it over, and that cured the problem. Quite an interesting facet in life. But that's what happens when sometimes things get switched on when you don't know. Whilst in Hong Kong, I became involved in the sporting activities of the station. And so we had tennis courts on there, and we got those refurbished. My friend of the station, another lead and tell, Mark Young, he left the station before I did. He was the stonecutter's representative to the Royal Naval Recreation Committee, and I was asked to take his place, which I did. I knew quite a few of them because I was a reserve for the Navy B football team in Hong Kong. I played two games for them, but at odd times. But there were two. The Navy ran two teams. The Navy A team was the best team with the best players from all the ships and from the shore establishments. But the Navy B team was mainly all shore-based personnel in Hong Kong. We were in Division 2 of the Hong Kong League. And so I knew quite a lot of people on the RNRC anyway. On one of the meetings, I found out that they had some money to spare. So I managed to get the allocation to get all our tennis courts refurbished. Managed to get football kits and some cricket, new sets of cricket gear. We used to play down on the marine, on a section of the rifle range, to one side of the rifle range. Because a stonecutters was the main rifle range for the British Pacific Fleet that was run by the Royal Marines, 600 yards down to the butts. And our football pitch was to one side of that, going inland from the beach. And there's a naffy there, which we never use, but what used to happen is that ships used to send over detachments of their crew for a week small arms firing and instruction, shooting instruction, which the Marines used to take. And consequence is that they were billeted on the island up by there, and used to use the naffy. We used to have many, many exciting games of football and that with them at odd times. We also, I found that they had, in the stores there, they had three canoes, commando canoes, so the type that were used on the raid in France, where they went up the river, the Gironde, and went up the river. These are the ones which they've got an inflatable bit of the way around, and you can fully immerse. Quite strong, and they're quite heavy, actually, for a canoe. But they, there are three of them, and I managed to get those. The station also managed to get a 14-foot sailing dinghy